Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson. We just got some new numbers for the governor's race. No, we're not talking about poll numbers, though runoffs are likely. We're talking about the millions of dollars pouring into this race that will soon be materializing itself on TV screens and in your mailbox over the next 2 months. Interested yet? I hope so, because we all have mailboxes, and you want to learn more about how much of that mail and how much of that TV screen time is going to be taken up with these candidates. So please listen to our entire podcast, including all four sections. Instead of listening to your coworker continue to talk about how she finished the Cooper River Bridge run, we get it, Brenda. Or questioning life after hearing Taylor Swift cover Earth, Wind, and Fire. Oh no, honey, no, who asked you for this? Brenda? Did you ask for this, Brenda? Why? Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that President Donald Trump has nominated Columbia lawyer Sherry Lydon to be the next U.S. attorney for South Carolina. If the U.S. Senate confirms her, she will become the state's first female U.S. attorney nominated and confirmed. Beth Drake is the current state U.S. attorney, but has been in the seat on an interim basis since January 2017, following Bill Nettles' resignation. Lydon runs her own firm specializing in white-collar criminal defense, public corruption, and healthcare fraud cases. Other names in the running for the job included Representative Peter McCoy, a Republican from Charleston, and South Carolina Department of Corrections Director Brian Sterling. Number two, the state reports that under pressure from the state's major utilities, the South Carolina House of Representatives killed a solar bill on Tuesday that was intended to protect thousands of jobs and save customers money on their monthly power bills. It was a reversal from a previous House vote. Now, since the bill deals with tax cuts, it needed a two-thirds vote to get to the Senate, which it did not have. Utilities have expressed concern about how competition from solar could affect them. The solar bill would have removed a cap that limits the expansion of solar power in the state. South Carolina is nearing its 2% limit on solar power, and unless that cap is removed, solar proponents say the rooftop solar industry will dry up and some 3,000 jobs will be lost. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that the Medical University Hospital has run out of space, partly because of psychiatric patients who have nowhere else to go except the ER. That's according to MUSC CEO Pat Cawley. The Charleston facility is running at, quote, 110% capacity, Cawley told hospital trustees. Every day, up to 25 patients with psychiatric or behavioral health issues stay at the emergency room at MUSC because the hospital cannot discharge them. A few factors are driving this trend, including the opioid crisis and the fact that the patient base is also growing. He also mentioned that the stigma surrounding mental health treatment isn't as bad as it used to be, so more patients are seeking help. And running up the quorum call number four, the Greenville News reports that state and federal investigators are looking into allegations of fraud involving South Carolina's Autism Children's Services Program. Now, details were limited according to State Senator Thomas Alexander, who revealed the problem. A spokeswoman for the state's Medicaid agency, where the program is funded, referred questions to the state attorney general's office. The AG's office was still getting information about the case. Alexander said the agency believes that what happened may have given officials the mistaken impression for years that the program's provider rates and availability were in better shape than they actually were. Now, the program has been under fire in recent years by parents and advocates for not paying providers enough money, causing some providers to leave the state. And just like that, we've buried the lead, like I've buried my fear of porcelain clowns. Why? This week in our big discussion, we've come to terms with the fact that we are now campaign trail people. Yes, we are trail people. It took months of realization, but you know what? Here we are. Can I get a whip crack on that? Thank you. Now, that doesn't mean our fourth segment, Campaign Trail, goes away. It just means that you need to be prepared for more campaign politics in our main discussion. So let's just embrace that fact for a minute. We're going to be talking more and more about the races, statewide and some local, as the legislative session winds down and the primary races heat up. So we brought back the Post and Courier's campaign trail guide, Jamie Lovegrove, to give a deeper look at the governor's race. Jamie, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here, Gavin.
It's also worth noting that Jamie is now our leader. You see what I did there? You see what I did there? Leader on our gold star board. Now, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, check out our Instagram at scleadpod and just give it a look, because we keep tally of how many guests we've had on the show. And right now, Jamie will be, what, it's like be six stars. So that's six gold stars. So that's pretty impressive for Jamie.
I'm very proud.
Now, he was in a three-way tie with Andy Brown and Andy Shane. So there's still a lot of going back and forth. But we'll talk about that at a later show. Let's get into what we're talking about today. The big draw this week is that we just saw some campaign finance disclosure numbers come out for the first quarter of 2018. And the governor's race continues to draw millions of dollars. The deadline was April 10th. We have all the Republican candidates' disclosures in. But as of Thursday afternoon, which is when we're taping for this week, none of the Democrats have filed yet. So we're still in a grace period for that time period. However, we're just going to be talking about Republican dollars for this episode, since that's what we have available. We'll get those Democrat numbers soon, and when we do, we'll put them on our social media account and possibly in a forthcoming campaign trail segment. So look forward to that. Now, remember, the state of South Carolina votes strong Republican, so the primaries are key to finding out who will essentially become the next governor. Right now, there are five Republican candidates for governor: Governor Henry McMaster, Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant, former Health Agency Director Catherine Templeton, former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill, and upstate businessman John Warren. That being said, we saw big bucks being raised here in the first 3 months of 2018, and this is our only glimpse into how much money these candidates have ahead of the June 12th primary. We won't get any disclosures till after that primary is over. So, Jamie, that being said, what are some of the big takeaways from these disclosures that we saw coming from these candidates? Who's winning the money race, and basically, why does that matter?
So, Governor Henry McMaster is still out on top. He has been on top throughout most of the race, but perhaps by less than you might expect for an incumbent, particularly an incumbent who has been in South Carolina politics for decades now and has a very deep and well-connected network. But he raised $741,000 over the first 3 months of 2018, and he now has just under $3 million as we head here into the last 2 months before the primary. Hot on his heels throughout the entire race has been Catherine Templeton, Mount Pleasant attorney, former two-time agency head. She raised $545,000 in the first 3 months of 2018, and she has a little over $2.5 million. There has been talk over the last few months, you know, whispers and rumors in the political circles in Columbia that maybe some of Templeton's donors were leaving her campaign or going to John Warren's campaign or going to Henry McMaster's campaign. But look, she is $2.5 million, $545,000 in 3 months. It's a pretty good haul.
Yeah.
Clearly, she's doing pretty well. And even if she doesn't raise another dollar for the rest of this race, which is not going to be a problem, she will raise plenty more dollars. $2.5 million is more than enough to run a very well-funded campaign.
And it's interesting to note that they both spent around roughly the same for those first 3 months. I mean, McMaster spent around $372,000. She spent $367,000. We saw her first campaign ad come out. I mean, that seems like some small spending, but I'm guessing a lot is going to go into the next 2 months ahead of the June 12th primary, because this is kind of make or break.
Exactly.
For that period.
And we've started to see some of that. I mean, it's been interesting. You know, both Governor McMaster and Ms. Templeton have been raising a lot of money for now a year and a half, and they really haven't spent a lot of it yet. Now is obviously the time when you're going to start seeing a lot of that money go towards mostly TV networks to get their ads on the air. We saw an ad from Catherine Templeton come out this week, her first TV ad, hyping up her a label that was used in the Post and Courier several years ago, describing her as a buzzsaw from her time at the health agency, DHEC. That was a headline from one of our reporters, Bo Peterson. It was about how she had come in. She was firing some of the bureaucrats there. She was making a lot of changes. She's kind of taken that on, that label, as a great point of pride as she comes in here. And she's trying to say, I'm going to come into Columbia and I'm going to shake up the political system. She put an ad out this week. We've already seen ads from John Warren, who is the newest candidate to enter the race. He came in. He actually didn't even officially enter until February. He's raised $150,000 in the first, well, I guess the first 2 months of his campaign, because he was not really raising money in January. And he's already started to spend some on TV as well. The big thing with John Warren, as we knew from the beginning of his campaign, he said this from the get-go, he was going to spend a lot of his own family's money in this race. He started a financial firm, Lima One Capital, and he said he would be using some of his own money. He kicked in $500,000, $500,000 already to his campaign. And he started to use that in the form of TV ads, introducing himself to voters. He is, you know, by virtue of getting into the race late and by virtue of not having run in anything before, not being in politics before, you know, his big challenge is making sure people know who he is. So a lot of his early ads have just been introducing himself. He's, you know, he keeps telling folks he's a Christian, conservative, Marine, businessman. That's the big label that he is trying to promote for himself. So he started to spend some of that. He has $266,000 on hand at the end of the first quarter. So he is going to have to, you know, raise a significant amount more or kick in a significant amount more to catch up with Ms. Templeton and Governor McMaster. But if he is willing to continue kicking in more money of his own, you know, it's going to be it would be nearly impossible to raise the kind of money that Governor McMaster and Catherine Templeton have raised so far in the last 2 months of this race. That's just a too high of a mountain to climb. But if he's willing to kick in a lot more of his own money, then he could make it competitive.
Well, and we should also point out that the other two candidates in this field, Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant and former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill, are really towards the bottom of this when it comes to fundraising. Bryant raised about $22,000 in the first quarter. McGill raised about $8,000. McGill only has $422 on hand. And Bryant has about $182,000 on hand. Worth noting, Bryant put $225,000 of his own money into this race as well. So really kind of a difficult spot for these two guys.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Bryant has said all along that he did not think he was going to be able to compete money-wise with some of these folks. You know, he has never made fundraising a central emphasis of his campaign. You know, he is reaching out to a, you know, very socially conservative block of voters. He has long championed, you know, pro-life efforts in the State House, continues to do so in his role as Lieutenant Governor. And, you know, former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill has been really in and out of the campaign trail. He has not been very visible throughout much of this race. And $423 at this point is not going to get you competitive in a city council race. So realistically, he's going to have to raise a lot more money if he wants to try to make a comeback. With that being said, you know, there are folks out in the PD in particular who really like Yancey McGill from his time as Lieutenant Governor, when he was actually a Democrat, technically.
And he was a senator from Williamsburg County.
Right.
So and he has those roots, but
he was, you know, always a conservative Democrat. And now he is identifying as a Republican. But again, you know, money is not everything in politics, but it's a lot, particularly in a race like this.
And when we see the poll numbers, you know, we've kind of seen this consistent track for poll numbers. Most recently, we saw a poll come out in early April that put McMaster at 46%, Templeton at 22%, Bryant at 6%. So, but of course, a good chunk still undecided at 22%. So that's kind of how it's been holding steady, those top three in a sense. Is the money key to helping avoid a runoff, or really just helping to get name recognition going for these guys out there? And if that's the case, what does McMaster have to do to kind of get away from that in terms of separating himself from
the field? Is going to be the central question of these last 2 months. You know, I think this has been the tale of this race for quite a long time now. I think even the challengers would tell you this. You know, it's about trying to get the governor into a runoff. If you can get Governor McMaster one-on-one for 2 weeks, you know, if you have a lot of money, you can blitz the airwaves. You can make this a referendum on Governor McMaster one-on-one with him. That's a very different race. It is very, very hard to imagine any of the four challengers besting McMaster or getting more than 50% themselves in the first round of voting. So if they collectively, as a group, the four of them, can keep him below that threshold, then it could be a very interesting runoff in those last couple weeks of the race. But for now, you know, I think we're in a similar position that we've been in. You know, we've seen Governor McMaster consistently be somewhere between 35 to 45, 46% in a lot of these polls. The question is, can he get those last few percent to cross that 50% threshold in the first round of voting?
And I mean, what do they have to do? I mean, do they just have to blitz? I mean, are we going to be? Is that what the takeaway is for this, for the layperson who's not really into the politics? I mean, they're going to probably start realizing that, hey, there's a primary going on because it's in my mailbox, it's on my Facebook feed, it's on my radio waves. But is that when it really starts to matter, when it is in these people's faces, and then that's when the message really starts to get I don't say convoluted, but it starts getting hotter and harder and honed as well. I mean, you get those attack ads going. Right. Like, we're known for that in South Carolina.
Look, South Carolina has a history of elections getting decided quite late. Governor Haley in 2010 was in fifth place or so around this time in April when she got the endorsement from Sarah Palin.
Yep.
Everything kind of spiraled from there, and she was able to end up coming out on top in that race. So, you know, folks, they may keep, you know, the corner of their eye on the race for most of the campaign, but they're not really going to start paying a lot of attention until these final few weeks when they're going to make up their mind. So it's not surprising to me that a lot of folks are undecided.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure it's exciting for these campaigns that they have a chance now to come out and convince these voters that they're the right person for the job. That is going to mean, as you say, a lot of advertising. It's going to be hard to turn on a television in South Carolina without seeing an ad for one of these campaigns, particularly in May and in those last few weeks before the race. If you watch a lot of Fox News right now, you're already seeing that.
Yeah.
You know, I'll turn on Fox and Friends in the morning, and you'll see John Warren ads followed by Catherine Templeton ads followed by John Warren ads. And it's just it's remarkable to see it take shape after it had been very quiet up to this point. People had really been building their resources, building those campaign war chests, and now is the war. So now is the time to unload it.
And we're going to see it across the state. We're not just going to see it in the upstate. I mean,
that's true.
Is there? I know we.
I'm in Columbia, and I've been seeing it. So.
And we've typically see a breakdown about where. I mean, where do these guys really want to go to get these bases riled up, Jamie? I mean, I kind of have an. I know where they're talking, that they're targeting, but when we look at the state, we look at the upstate, the Midlands, the Lowcountry, the PD.
Yeah.
Where is the battleground for these voters in the primary for the Republicans, at least?
So, certainly the conventional wisdom is that it's the upstate, and look, that's where the bulk of primary voters are. It's where the most committed partisans are, which are the kind of folks that vote in political primaries. And, you know, it's a very conservative part of the state. So it's where you're going to have to really prove that you have the credentials to count as a true conservative. So we have been seeing all of the candidates spend an awful lot of time up there. You know, that has been a constant dynamic throughout this race. You know, part of the reason for that was Catherine Templeton lives in the Lowcountry.
Mm-hmm.
Governor McMaster is from Columbia, is from the Midlands. You know, he had a law practice here. He, you know, has built his political career here. So people in the Midlands know him very well. And so there was an element of the upstate kind of being in play. Of course, Lieutenant Governor Bryan is from Anderson, but, you know, that's not Greenville or Spartanburg where the real the numbers are. You know, John Warren adds an interesting dynamic to the race in that he is from Greenville. But again, he had not been in elected office before. He had not run for political office before. So it's not like Greenville voters necessarily know who he is, even though he is from up there. So, yeah, I think we will see a lot of competition for that part of the state. And I expect you're going to see a lot of campaign stops up there and campaign rallies and events over these last couple months before June 12th.
And have we already seen some of that sniping that we're known for in South Carolina politics? I mean, it seems like some little things here and there that maybe if you're only on Twitter, you might be attuned to. But I mean,
if you're on these folks' fundraising lists, they're pretty direct there. That's interestingly one of the places where you're most likely to see it is if you are on Catherine Templeton's fundraising list. You get an email from her and it's coming pretty heavily against Governor McMaster, and it's also accusing him and his campaign of using dirty tactics is kind of a message we've seen from her. They haven't really alleged specific things, but they've said there's dirty tricks going on. You know, you need to keep an eye out. You know, Governor McMaster a couple weeks ago sent an email about Catherine Templeton. His campaign sent an email about Catherine Templeton and how she was, you know, lying about some of her past experiences or, you know, things like that. So you have seen a little bit of pretty openly.
Mm-hmm.
On the ad front, we have not seen that yet. You know, on the ad front, it has been mostly positive ads so far. Ads from these candidates about themselves as opposed to about their opponents. But, you know, campaigns have a tendency to get pretty aggressive the longer they go. And when you get into the heat of the moment, I would not be surprised if we start seeing some negative ads come out too. You know, voters often say that they don't like negative ads. They claim that, you know, it just feels dirty and they don't like to see it. But there's a lot of political science research that shows that they are pretty effective, and they do make a difference in some of these races. So I would not be surprised to see these campaigns start pulling it out pretty soon.
Kind of like how everyone says that they don't like bad news, but we all look at the clicks, we all look at the numbers.
Right,
I mean,
right,
the media,
exactly.
It's like, but you like the bad news. And now, I mean, we don't like the bad news. We just publish the news because guess what? That's the news. We don't pick it. We just report it. Jamie, I want to close out. Again, I'm talking to Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier, who is our campaign trail guide. And I know I talked at the top and mentioned at the top that the Democrats are also running this race. There's three Democratic candidates.
Yeah.
But since they did not put their filing in their disclosures for the first quarter of fundraising that were due April 10th, they're still in a grace period, but they haven't been updated yet. So,
we can't
really talk about that. But what does that indicate to you that if those numbers aren't already in yet when the Republicans were chomping at the bit to tell us what they raised?
So we're taping here on April 12th. We're a full, you know, we're going on a full 2 days after the deadline. And as you said, there is a 5-day grace period. And even after the grace period, the penalties are very minimal. Mm-hmm. South Carolina does not exactly have the most stringent ethics laws for its candidates. But with that being said, it's just if a Democrat is going to win in South Carolina in 2018, they are going to have to run a very, very well-executed campaign. They are going to have to be a well-oiled machine. They are going to be up against the best political strategists in the state, very experienced campaign folks, people who do not make mistakes very often. Missing the fundraising deadline, all three of them, you know, it's not a big deal, but it is just a sign that there is, you know, on a technical level, they still need to ramp up these campaigns a little bit. You know, you would expect, because of the fact that there is a primary, that these campaigns would now at this point be kind of ramping up. And we have seen all the campaigns hire some staffers and build out a little bit. But, you know, it's the small things like this that at the end of the day, if you're going to beat a Republican in a traditionally red state like South Carolina, crossing the T's and dotting the I's matters. You know, it's a little surprising to see that all five Republican candidates were able to file their campaign finance reports on time, and none of the three Democrats were. First, we were wondering if there was maybe some issues with the Ethics Commission website, but it turns out that's not really the case. So it's just curious to see that, and it's a little inauspicious if you're a Democrat waiting for what's going to happen after June 12th.
And that's Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier giving us an update on the gubernatorial race, especially the fundraising dollars that we just saw released this week. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Gavin.
And just a reminder, you have less than a month to register to vote for the June 12th primary. Chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you already vote because you're educated and informed.
Aww.
But if you have friends that aren't as smart as you, go and tell them and get them to vote. Because I don't care who they vote for or what their politics are, just get them to exercise their right to vote, because that's what it's all about, folks. And also get them to listen to our podcast.
Amen.
Please and thank you. Boy, that was a long campaign trail. Wait a minute, what? We're still on the campaign trail? We are campaign trail people. We're never leaving. Well, let's just shake that off and put our smiley faces on and not think about our fear of clowns, porcelain clowns. They're everywhere. We are less than 2 months away from the June 12th primary, and that means it's time to start planning out your primary day checklist. Let's see, register to vote, check. Don't wear partisan attire or buttons to the polls, check. Bring treats to the poll workers. Check, check, check. And have a current form of identification. Check. Okay, so now on primary day, you get to decide which race you want to vote on, and you'll be given either a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot. Yes, those ballots will have different candidates on them, but they will also have some different questions on them, which parties use to gauge support on an issue. The Democratic primary ballot will have three questions on the ballot. The first is, do you oppose drilling and exploration for oil off the coast of South Carolina? Question two will be, do you support passing a state law allowing doctors to prescribe medical marijuana to patients? And the third question that will be on the Democratic primary ballot will be asking you if you support passing a state law requiring the governor of South Carolina to accept all federal revenues offered to support Medicaid and Medicaid expansion efforts in the state. quite a few questions on the Democratic ballot, and that stands in contrast to the one question that's on the Republican Party's ballot. Now, currently in South Carolina, we have what's called open primaries. Hence, you have the ability to vote in the Republican primary if you're a Democrat, or vice versa, for example. You don't have to register by party in South Carolina. So, the ballot question on the Republican primary ballots will say, do you believe that voters should have the option to choose to affiliate with a political party when they register to vote or change their voter registration in South Carolina? Now, it's worth noting that the South Carolina GOP State Executive Committee unanimously passed a resolution calling for a partisan voter registration option on voter registration forms in South Carolina. And also in the State House, a House bill aimed at closing the state's primaries has not gone anywhere. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. The section is named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that the South Carolina House and Senate have their own signature melee weapons? Well, the House is represented by a mace and the Senate by a sword. You can see both of these weapons on display in their respective chambers. Now, occasionally we see the two weapons come together, like during the joint session last Wednesday, or on Thursday when House Speaker Jay Lucas rolled up into the Senate chamber to ratify bills, which is part of the process of a bill becoming a law. You can check out the SC Lead Pod Instagram to see a photo of that right now. Now, Lucas was escorted by House officials, including the Sergeant-at-Arms Mitch Dorman, who carried the 11-pound solid silver mace, which is 262 years old. Now, this mace was made in London and is the only one in America that predates the Revolutionary War. The Revolutionary War!
Wow!
During the war, it went missing and was later found when a South Carolinian became president of the Bank of the United States in Philadelphia. But 152 years later, that mace went missing again. For 20 days in 1971, it disappeared. But who didn't in 1971? State law enforcement started investigating current and former employees and suspected the former Statehouse security chief. That same chief had just left his job in Florida, and it was found, guess what, in his trunk in Gainesville and triumphantly returned to the House. It can be seen on display behind the well in the House during session and in a display case behind the rostrum at other times. Now, that sword in the Senate we were talking about is also on display in the Senate. However, it's a replacement for the original sword that was made in 1704 and went missing in 1941, and we still have not seen that original sword. After that went missing, a cavalry sword that served in the War of 1812 and the Civil War was a stand-in until former British ambassador Lord Halifax gifted the state a new sword, crafted in London in 1951. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to keep you informed. Watch my Statehouse video recaps every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, live at 7 p.m. on SCETV's Facebook, YouTube, and my Twitter account, at Gavin Jackson. Read the Statehouse Daybook on SCETV.org, and listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find podcasts. You can also find us on the NPR One app. Follow us on Instagram at SCLEDEPOD, that's SC Lead Pod, and you can see photos from the studio, around the Statehouse, and when I'm on assignment. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SC Lead Pod. Email questions, comments, or your gripes, including how I say cavalry, to SCLEDE at SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on April 13th, 2018. Ooh, Friday the 13th. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. And come on, Brenda, really? Taylor Swift? Earth, Wind & Fire? Come on, Brenda. We know you won the race.